Thank you all. Thank you, Anna. I'm glad to be back. It's been quite a while. Hey, Maureen. It's been a few years. This is my third time being with Word and Life. And I was, after a couple of years passed and I hadn't been invited back, I was wondering if I said something. Anyway, I'm glad that Judith Valenti really enjoys the wool. I don't talk about it often. For one reason is that my work is in an earlier period. My research pretty much ends about a century before he came into the world. And there are other reasons, and I'll touch on them as we go, but there are other reasons. I don't know a lot about the rule or Benedict. I took a class years ago when I was studying for my master's in monks, and that was pretty much it. I was more intrigued by the Desert Fathers because of their social dislocation, because they did not have institutional support. In fact, they were countercultural in a lot of ways. And so that's during my period of research. So again, it's not my period, and also there were some odd practices that I didn't find extremely accessible. So I'm telling you why I didn't want to read it at first, but I have to tell you, I am glad that I read it, but I had a little resistance at first. Also because I'm taking care of my mom from a distance. She lives in Oxnard. I have siblings who live closer, but I am the eldest son, and my dad died just 5 months ago. So it's been a different world, as I'm sure you can imagine. And for some time, I couldn't concentrate when it came to reading, especially anything serious. So my wife and I have watched so many movies, more than ever in our life, because I couldn't absorb, you know. I'd read and then go back 2 paragraphs. You know how that goes. Even with audiobooks, I would listen to audiobooks, and then I'd, what am I listening to? Oh. And so I was a little reluctant just because of that. In fact, my friend Maureen here, she's involved with Clue. She's stepping down from her her supervisorial presidential role on the board. But I've been on the board, and I stepped away from that and a number of other things just to reorient myself. So all that to say, I didn't want to read. And again, let me just say a little bit more about the countercultural aspect of how monasticism started, but then it became acceptable and part of institution, church institution. And all of my favorite Catholics and Protestants are rebels, it seems. You know, and they usually get canonized later than everybody else. Which is, I don't understand the psychology. I reject you, but you've been dead a long time, so come on in. And some of them never get canonized. I, for the life of me, I still haven't figured out why Tertullian is one who was not canonized. And Origen, who really laid the groundwork for what became institutional church in many ways. Another one is, who got canonized late was Nestorius. Nestorius was he's a big shot in church life, but he ran afoul of the doctrinaire people, and one of the guys wanted his job. He had a cushy bishopric. Cyril of Alexandria started fighting against Nestorius. Nestorius gets banished and goes off into the east, you know, into Persia and beyond. And so there are a lot of Nestorian Christians in that part of the world today. I'm more intrigued by that than those who were blessed and given a historic blank check. And this is true today. People who ask questions intrigue me. People who don't fit in, as many of you know, would be true of someone like Richard Rohr. Yeah, they just don't fit in, but I find them enchanting. Well, here's why I was glad to pick the book up at chapter 9. Personally, I intersected with, in my despondency, with the talk about night, because my nights were not good. My nights were dismal. They were painful. They were often sleepless. And I'm just going to read an excerpt. The night is often a foreboding time. The writer of Psalm 63 prays to be counted and not forgotten in these hours of seeing dimly, of confronting our vulnerable places. Oh God, I remember you upon my bed. I muse on you through the watches of the night. My soul clings fast to you, he writes. Ancient desert monks often sat up throughout the night. They understood that night is a descent into the basement of the unconscious. The knives of our various anxieties are removed from their sheaths. The psyche dissects the petty slights, angry words, and annoyances of the day just past. It stirs insecurities about the day ahead. Is it any wonder that nearly half of all Americans over the age of 12 have taken some kind of prescription sedative? How can we sleep soundly when our inner world is raging? Saint Benedict wanted to compline the last prayers of the monastic day to steady the community for rest. Now, Lord, let your servant go in peace. Your word has been fulfilled. We pray during confine. They are the words of Simeon, the Jewish elder we meet in the New Testament, who believes his life is finally complete when he sees the Savior of Israel. He is ready for eternal rest. As the Abbey of Gethsemane, a lovely hymn accompanies that prayer, just as the monks prepare to retire to their beds. Lord, save us while we are awake. Protect us while we are asleep, that we may keep our watch with Christ, and when we sleep, rest in his peace. I like to use this time before retiring to complete what the Benedictine writer Macrina Whitaker calls a spiritual gleaning. A gleaning is someone who walks through fields gathering what has been left by reapers. At day's end, she says, ask yourself, does anything come together in a clearer picture? Is there anything I missed? How does this day of creation feel in my heart? Has the day been, for me, a deep listening, a patient waiting, a tender abiding, a loving romance, and a joyful expectation. I'm going to skip down. Each night unfolds the promise of another beginning. When the time for sleep ends, a new day of action begins. We return the knives of our anger, anxiety, and insecurity to their holders. With a prayerful attitude, they can become once again tools for our work, not the weapons of our fears. Well, you know, I would tell my wife during daylight hours, I said, you know, when I get up and I move forward, I'm relatively fine. But when night closes in, I am restless. I'm next to you in bed and you are asleep. And here's the interesting thing. A month after my dad died, my wife's brother died. And I was not in town. And I remember her face when we were on FaceTime, and she told me, and we were both just feeling really deprived. And so here she was trying to be my supporter and comforter, and now all of a sudden I am hers. And as a pastor, I do all the funerals. Not just outside the family, but in the family too. And so, I haven't done a lot of family funerals on my side, because, and I'll get to that in just a moment, but I've done a lot on my wife's side of the family over the years. I officiated the funerals of her grandmother, of her father, her mother, of her sister, of her nephew, and then more recently of her brother. So my contact with death has been through her family, my closest contact. And she would often say, I don't know how you do it. You're grieving with us, but you are leading us at the same time. Well, what this eventuates in is a sensitivity to people's sorrow, where I know we have to keep moving forward. We have to keep moving forward, even though, and we're not leaving them behind. We're taking them with us. And like that famous song of the 70s or 60s, "He ain't heavy. He's my brother, or my father or grandmother," and so on. And so keep moving on, keep moving forward. So as I read this, I felt like somebody was joining me in my sorrow. I felt like if not Benedict, the author Judith, was there, somebody I could connect with. And the talk about night was unexpected. You know, it's early in my segment to address, and I was really glad. I don't know if you noticed, chapter 9 is about half as long as chapter 10. And so that being one of the first things I was reading, I needed a short chapter. I didn't read chapter 10 until sometime after, but I needed something concise, something to chew on. I needed fast food, if you will, I think. And this was really what the doctor ordered. And I won't say that I am yet at a place where I look forward to night. My wife and I have developed a practice of praying many nights together, which I have found very helpful. Very restorative. We pray in the morning, but we were not night prayers. And something about this encounter, we can't call it complying. There's no real structure to it, but we are really just giving thanks. We give thanks for things that we're conscious of, and as we pray, we become aware of things that we can give thanks for that we hadn't thought of, or one of us hadn't thought of, but now we share together. So we've adopted this practice in our own tailored way. Something that that I read, what's really is close to my heart, is the Eucharist. And on page 95, it doesn't talk about the Eucharist, but it talks about community. It doesn't talk about the Eucharist, but it talks about community. And, you know, there's a fine line between the meaning of those things. It's easy to want to turn away from problems I alone can't solve. There is, though, something I can do to extend that sense of community and belonging I experienced the first time I stepped foot in Mount St. Scholastica. It goes back to something else Sister Molly told me. It is really quite simple when we finally realize it. Community is about the people sitting right next to you. It's not about some lofty thing we need to aspire to. It's honoring the relationships right around us. So that's how I think. And I think that way about communion. And as a person who asks questions and does not accept easily things that are institutional, I have a different way of thinking. And you know, we have communion every Sunday in our churches, and it's kind of a traditional thing. But I tell people not to put too much weight on this event. It's important for us to come together and do this. I think the bread and the wine are significant. They are wonderful, and Jesus introduced this as a practice among his disciples, saying that this is my body and this is my blood. But I tend to see the way that we do communion as a cultural export from a small region in the world. And it causes us to lose some of the meaning, I think, of what it's for. Because not every place in the world can you have bread, and certainly not wine. And I think that communion, just as legitimate as bread and wine, are quesadillas and horchata, and sushi and sake, and grilled cheese sandwiches and Capri Sun. I don't think the point of communion is to practice something that happened a long time ago, so much as it is to practice something that pertains to our present moment. And so when I read in this book, it's a community is about honoring the relationships around us. It's not about trying to tweak them by implementing religious practice so much, is to study the religious practice for its true significance, to find out that there is no line between sacred and secular, that God is, that the holy is, and holiness is in the burrito as much as it is in the wafer. And when we see it this way, it allows us to not create holiness, but recognize holiness everywhere we go. And it causes us to appreciate every meal that we enjoy with whomever it is as holy as well. I have a thought about stability that you read about in chapter 10. So back to my dad. He and Mom came here 65 years ago, almost 66 years ago. They left North Carolina to come west. My dad's reasoning for this, I didn't know. I mean, I was actually pretty well into life when he explained that he began to share some of his experience in the Jim Crow South, and he didn't want his kids to ever witness a lynching or have to go into the back door of restaurants and such. So he wanted a fresh start. So he and Mom got married and in 1953 and left 2 weeks later on a train to come westward. And on the train, when they were sitting on the train, they were the only two black people. And so the porter came and drew a curtain between them and everybody else. But they had so much love and joy that it didn't bother them. They were leaving. We did not grow up with our family. Most of our aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins lived not just in North Carolina, but they moved up towards Washington, D.C. and New York and other places, but mostly still in North Carolina. And so all that to say, we grew up without much other family, so all we had, and really all we have, is us. My parents have 9 children. My dad's greatest joy was that all 9 of us outlived him. That was really significant for him. And Mom has advanced Alzheimer's, and so that's why it's important for me to be ongoingly attentive and work with caregivers and family. And all of this, as you know, can be really, it's like another job, all right? I told my wife, I said, after I went to our 2 churches this past weekend, I said, now I'm on to my 3rd church. and that was taking care of Mom. The fact that my parents came here without family and we rarely visited them means that we had to develop family-like relations with people here in California. We live between the Bay Area and Oxnard. And so we have some deep relationships with people that we consider family. Dad and Mom were married for 65 years. And on the week of the funeral, the first week in April, the church that I oversee in Oxnard seats about 200 people. And 3 or 4 days before my dad's service, it was vandalized. And so my youngest sister started looking around town for another place to have it. And we were graciously offered. St. Paul Baptist Church says, you know, you don't have to pay. We normally charge $1,500. And they said, we want to give this as a gift to your family. This speaks to the stability. My dad had cachet in the community, not because he was visible or active. He just loved his wife and his kids. And that's what he was known for more than anything. People who eventually worked for him when he was in civil service came to the funeral. I had friends who came to the funeral from Santa Barbara. We changed from a building that seated 200 to one that seated 700, and it was full. And so, I mean, we didn't anticipate that. But it says something about long-term, you know, the Benedictine way of life is to be in one place for a long period of time. And so there are benefits to that, you know. And, you know, I applaud and enjoy people who are very transient and they can move here and work there and live here and move there. That's, you know, I think that takes a special grace to do that, but it's not everybody's grace. And I think that I have inherited this sense for stability from my parents. And later this month, we will have our 42nd anniversary, Diane and I. And I've been pastor of the church here in Santa Barbara for 36 years. And the church in Oxnard for 26 years. So if I don't have much to offer beyond that, there has been some stability in our lives. There's something to be said. I'm not sure exactly what it is. I'll close. I don't even know how much time I have or how much I've taken. How are we doing? Oh, that much time? Okay. Oh, okay. So, you know, another thing that doesn't always appeal to me about, and this includes Benedict, who was he descended from nobility, is that the monastic world at this time and beyond, for the most part, was populated with aristocrats. And, you know, when I think Jesus, I don't think aristocrats, you know, and the way that many of them became monks is they were the second born or third born in their family. And so they did not inherit, you know, they didn't have primogeniture. So, but that doesn't mean that they were poor. And in fact, to be a monk, I mean, who takes a vow of poverty if they're already poor? It's like, I don't need to make any promises. I think it's happening already. And I've always been disturbed about the chastity vow, especially the way that it was enacted in ancient times and beyond. There's a story of Benedict when he was a young monk who was aroused when he thought of a particular young woman. So he ran into thorny bushes. And his idea was that his spirit would be saved if his body paid the price. I think there are better ways, actually. but it's kind of problematic to, I have, you know, there's a vow of obedience, which, like I said, the heroes of the faith that I aspire to at some point they had to become disobedient. And so, you know, not just in a religious sense or in an institutional sense, I think that that we need to applaud dissidents. And of course, that doesn't mean that everybody who disagrees is a legitimate dissident. Not every rebel has a cause. I am attracted to people who have the courage to pay the price and experience loss because of their convictions. I'm enchanted with them. And I find that the ones especially that I study tend to have a spiritual practice of some type that grounds them. And so therefore, they cannot merely be called institutional people of faith. But they are actual people of faith. And you have to be a person of faith to buck the trends, to not fit in, knowing that you could die and not be recognized, but then get canonized maybe 5-6 centuries later, but that's not really what's on your mind. I have this theory, I mean, if you look at the 12th century, that period there in Europe, I have this theory that Francis of Assisi forced the hand of the church because he lived so close to headquarters. There were other people who just ended up either getting kicked out or quitting in, you know, as far away as, say, Germany or Ireland or whatever. But Francis was somebody the church had to deal with because he lived next door. He didn't fit in. He didn't really like what he was doing, but he was popular. Have you ever had to deal with somebody who was popular that you didn't like? That's Francis of Assisi. People did not like what he was doing. The community didn't like it. The church didn't like it. But they had to deal with it. But to me, that only underscores the significance of the lives of those who were martyred and those who were banished, excommunicated. We tend to think of excommunication as something that follows sin, when in fact, historically, it has followed those who choose to disobey, those who choose to disagree. Well, you know, and there are some good things that went with, and there's more than chastity and poverty and obedience. You know, they emphasize physical labor and common meals, and these things are really, really life-giving. But it does still speak to the aristocratic flavor of monasticism. I know that some of you have been, when it was here, and greatly loved Casa Serena. And I remember being there for various spiritual activities on a weekend, a Saturday or Sunday. And there would invariably be personnel there who would be in charge of refreshments, coffee, things like that, or different jobs, clean up. And I would think, while I was there, I would think about them. And I would think, you know, they don't have the freedom, the financial freedom, to be at home with their families on the weekend. And I'm enjoying something that they probably can't experience. And I concluded that they're probably, even though I'm here listening to the chime, being silent or listening to someone lead me in some experience, I concluded that they're probably more spiritual than I am. And it puts things in perspective. That I can go to whatever lengths to exercise my spirituality so that I can be better adjusted to myself and God. I can do that. But how much does it matter when you set it against the special blessing that goes along with communion, community and communion. And my heart wanted to reach out to the people who worked there, and instead of just serving refreshments, I thought we should be enjoying refreshments together, which never happened. I never followed through on that. I'm a rebel, but I guess maybe not enough. So I'm gonna stop there and see if anybody has any feedback or questions or protest. I love protest.
Well, thanks for inviting us to give you some feedback and questions. I wonder if you have any off-the-hand thoughts on our visual culture today as opposed to or distinct from, you might say, a verbal culture at the time of Benedict. And it wasn't all verbal because they did marvelous frescoes back then, too. But what do you see as the interplay, if there is any, or the interest in thinking about images, visual images?
Okay. Well, you're asking somebody who's probably watched 50 movies this year. And I have to say that most of the movies have been comedy. Good therapy. I remember the first movie that we tried to watch after Dad died, and Diane and I were sitting there, I'm thinking it was Netflix or something like that, and the movie started, and within 5 minutes I was in tears. It was a drama, and they haven't even got dramatic yet. And so I still haven't watched that movie. So we decided to look for comedies, and so some of them are good and some of them are bad, but the visual has help to sustain us. But even more than that, we had a staycation last month, and we hiked. We went up to Lizard's Mouth and Nahokie Falls. Have you ever been to Guadalupe Dunes? I didn't even know there was such a thing until like 2 months ago, and it's Oceano Dunes. So we went places like that, and we went to Pismo Beach for 3 days and had a room close to the water where we could hear it 24 hours a day. And that part of the visual life, I think, is life-giving. The screen's not as much as the actual. And yes, we're living in a culture where our kids and grandkids, their lives are on screens. And so they don't, I grew up in a world where toys did not have to be charged. They didn't have to be plugged in. Yeah? Remember, we had hula hoops and frisbees and Play-Doh and hopscotch and jacks and marbles. This matchbox cars, all of these things. We even had trees, and scissors to make paper dolls. All of these things, you didn't need electricity to. We were so easily entertained. I mean, think about the slinky. I mean, just you have to be maybe pretty bored to think that that's fun. but that's where we were. We were more settled, I think, and quiet, and we wanted to be outdoors. We would rather be outdoors than indoors. That's changed, but we wanted to be out there. We wanted to be out where it was sunny, and if it was rainy, hoping our parents didn't call us in from the rain because we wanted to be with our friends in community in communion outdoors. And there's one toy that that I remember that inspires me. You remember Jack in the Box? Okay, so Jack in the Box is like my hero. Because for this to work, somebody has to stuff Jack in a box first. You know, there are always people who want to stuff you in a box. So they push you down. And then they put a lid over you. But while you're in there, you hear the music starting to play. I love music and the power of music. And I know that some of you probably have songs at particular times in your life experience that become extremely important. They may be songs that you play over and over and over again because of their capacity to strengthen you and lift you up. Well, when the music started, it was always the same song. Right? But in real life, we have music. When we're in our box and the lid is over us, we have music, and the music tells us that we're getting out of here. They may try to push us down and squeeze us in and put us in a box and under a lid, but we're coming out of here. And when we do come out of here, we're going to shock the people who put us in here. Okay, so that's a really long response to your question.
We're going to have a very thorough question and answer period, but why don't we take a break, coffee break right now?
Okay.
Is everybody ready for a break?